This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I'm honored to visit with author Linda Maria Frank, who joins me from the state of New York in the United States of America to talk about the latest in the series of Annie Tillery mysteries titled The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Welcome, Linda, to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Jay. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Great to talk with you. This book, titled The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, is a continuation of a series of books that you have written. Would you describe your style and content as the same audience? What age would that be?
Actually, The Mystery of the Lost Avenger is number 4 in the Annie Tillery mystery series. So I like to call my books Nancy Drew meets CSI, because when I was a kid, I loved Nancy Drew. Actually, Nancy made me a lifetime reader. And then I taught forensic science, and I decided to marry the two and come up with some stories. I spent my life in the classroom with young minds who liked good stories, and that's actually how I got started writing. I used to write silly stories for them. And then that evolved into, let me see if I can write a book.
Oh, phenomenal. You as an instructor, as an educator, you have brought all of those tools into the writing field as well. You have, in writing your books, the creative process, have you always, even from a young age, been a creative?
I've been creative, but I can't say that I really love to write. I got really into writing as a part of my teaching career, because when you teach, you end up doing a lot of writing, and my creativity was to write curriculum that was interesting. I taught science, and I just thought there's such a wealth of fun things you can do in science, so I ended up writing curriculum, and along with the curriculum, I wrote stories. I made up stories for the kids. Some were true, some were silly. My favorite story is that Isaac Newton invented the Fig Newton. to make money so he could support his scientific career. So that was one of my silly stories.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a cute one.
Of course, I'm a silly guy. I'm a silly person, so I would obviously gravitate toward that. I'm not the master of puns, but I use them quite frequently. The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Now, you also have dabbled into the historical accuracy in this novel. There are some key points that actually are based on history.
Yes. Well, this is what I try to do. I can't get the educator out of me. So all of my books have mystery, history, and science. And in The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, it's a story that takes place in two times. And my heroine, Annie Tillery, actually gets in touch with her ancestry. Her great-grandmother happened to be a WASP, which is Women's Air Service Pilots. In World War II, she worked for Grumman and tested planes. That's true. I mean, not the character of her grandmother, but actually
right.
WASPs did test planes for Grumman. Grumman Aviation was one of the major producers of planes during World War II, and the plant is right here on Long Island, so it was easy to do the research. I just went to the Cradle of Aviation Museum. In fact, my inspiration came from that. I was at the Cradle of Aviation Museum, because Long Island is the Cradle of Aviation, with my family, and they were off doing whatever they were doing, and I was wandering around, and I came across this plane. The Avenger is an airplane, and it was instrumental in winning the war in the Pacific. So in front of this plane is a plaque dedicated to the women who built it, tested it, and flew it to California, to the air bases.
Mm.
And this is one of those days that you could actually climb into the airplane. So, of course, Linda climbed into the airplane. I sat in the seat. And you know what? It's so funny because the dashboard on your 2015, 16 SUV is more complicated than the instrument panel on this plane.
Fascinating.
And I sat there, and this feeling came over me. I never really had that happen to me, and I said, I have to write a story about these women. So that was the inspiration, and it went from there. And also in the book, it talks about actual German spies that made their way to Long Island. That's true as well. Submarines actually dropped spies off. Some of them were apprehended. We actually got a lot of information from one of the spies who actually willingly decided that he needed to tell what was going on. It was probably in the middle of the war, and maybe things weren't looking so good for the Germans. I don't know. But those things are true. The rest of it is, the rest of the plot is fiction.
How did you get introduced to Annie Tillery? Where did she come from?
Annie Tillery is the teenager I would have loved to have been. She's basically a girl who's a compilation of my favorite students. I won an award for inspiring girls to go into science. So I had a lot of girl students who impressed me. And so I decided that I would create a role model for girls. And I wanted her to be attractive, not beautiful, smart, but not nerdy. You know, I wanted her to be the kind of girl that today's teenagers could relate to, or today's girls could relate to. She's adventurous. She's a risk taker. And she just loves to get into some kind of a puzzle that she can solve. So her name comes from, well, I just think Annie is cute. And then I was stuck in a traffic jam on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and the exit was Tillery Street.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
And I spelled it wrong.
Well, you did well.
So that's where she comes from.
Is the story and the characters totally immersed in the era of World War II?
It goes back and forth. It's set in 1943 in the Grumman plant, and it's set in the present in the ancestral home of Annie in New Windsor, Maryland, and also on Long Island in Republic Field. So it goes from the present back to 1943. It goes back and forth.
Do all of your novels with Annie Tillery do the same?
What do you mean, be the same setting?
Not the same setting, but do they also have that same time frame?
No. This is the only one that goes back and forth in time. So
excellent.
the other novels all stay in the present.
Have you had any response to this novel yet? I mean, what has been the response?
The people who've read it as either beta readers or people who've just bought the book and read it, because the book's only been out for a month. So they love it. They absolutely love it because it's very it's kind of emotional because Annie is getting in touch with her past. She never knew about this person, and it's making her so proud that she had an ancestor who did what her great-grandmother did. And at the end, she meets with four of her great-grandmother's surviving friends who actually worked with her. And the end of the book is pretty emotional. It's a sweet book.
Most of my authors have a technique for laying out a story. Did you sit down and actually do an outline, or was this something that just grew organically, carried along by the characters?
No, I can't write that. What I have to do is I have to write an outline because it's a mystery. Everything has to dovetail at the end. You can't just go off on little bird walks and have them not show up at the end of the book. So I do an outline. I get an idea for a story. I do an outline, then I do a chapter outline, and then I actually do a flow chart with clues. If I introduce a clue, it has to end up somewhere making sense, and so I do a flow chart of how it's going to move through the chapters, and then I also do a character outline. So I'm very organized as far as the way I write, and my writing style is what I try to do is at the end of every chapter, I try to say something, do something, introduce something that makes you want to go on to the next chapter. I also try to introduce an emotional angle. In other words, it's not just a mystery story. It's not just a history story. There's an emotional angle where Annie is getting involved with either her boyfriend, Ty, her mother, her grandmother, her father. She lives with her aunt, who is a New York City police detective. So something is always going on in her life as well as the mystery.
Is there some action in here also that may attract even some male readers?
Action? Oh, yes. Well, I think the male readers will be very interested. I've actually had teachers buy a classroom set of my books, and, of course, the class is mixed boys and girls, and then they send me questions and comments, and the boys like the books just as much as the girls. But what's in this book for boys is just a lot about airplanes. Annie's boyfriend, Tyler Egan, gets his pilot's license. So they spend some time in the air, and they also spend some time talking about the features of the plane. And then, of course, there's a lot about the features of the Avenger and the history of the Avenger. Boys are usually interested in airplanes and their history and how they impacted the American scene, so to speak.
Absolutely. In a couple of sentences, explain to my listeners why they should also get a copy of this book along with your others in the series.
Well, the books are, if you liked CSI, if you like forensic science, you like solving a scientific puzzle and understanding the science behind it, all of my books include that. You also have characters who are fun. There's some humor in the book. For instance, the book before this is called Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys. And there's nothing about fairies in this. Fairy chimneys are a geological formation in Turkey. But there are two characters in the book, a boy and a girl. They're 12-year-old twins, and they try to convince Annie to use a Ouija board to channel Nancy Drew to solve the mystery. So there's a lot of humor and silliness in the book, which, you know, keeps you chuckling. So they're fun. These books are just fun. If you're an adult, and I have a lot of adult readers, actually, they will transport you back to when you were 11 or 12 years old and you were reading Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and all those fun things. So I try to make them fun, but I also try to educate at the same time in a way that's interesting.
Linda, the title is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Who is the Lost Avenger and how did that title come about?
Okay, the Avenger is a Grumman plane that was actually used in World War II, and it was significant in winning the war in the Pacific. And what happens in the book is the wreckage of an Avenger is found in the Appalachian Mountains. Grumman knew it was missing. They didn't know what happened to it, but it was found by some prospectors for mining in the mountains of Appalachia. And then, of course, once it was discovered, the NCIS, because it's a Navy plane, investigated and found a note in it from Annie Tillery's grandmother, great-grandmother, and that's how she found out about the plane crash, and the story goes from there.
Beautiful story. The title, again, is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, an Annie Tillery mystery. My author, Linda Maria Frank. Linda, where can my listeners get copies of your book?
You can get copies on the Archway website, and you also can get them in Amazon. And if you go on my website, which is lindamariafrank.com, that's the easiest way to get to get a copy of the book.
Have you been inspired to continue with an additional mystery in the near future?
Well, what's happened with this is that Annie and her boyfriend are going off to college, and they're just about, you know, they're young adults now. And I'm thinking that I may decide the next book is going to be an adult mystery.
Interesting.
Same characters, because they keep growing up. I can't keep them. I can't trap them at the age of 18 or 19.
It's hard to do that, absolutely. I've got a grandson who just turned 18, so I can relate. The title of this book, again, is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Listeners, if you want to get a copy of this and your local bookseller does not have it, they can order it in by request. Again, the author, Linda Maria Frank. Thank you, Linda, for joining me today.
And thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis. And the author is Charlie Wirz, and Charlie joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, how are you today?
Great to have you with us. America in Crisis. I think most people would see America's having big problems, and you're proposing that we as Americans, we're the ones to step forward and just not just think about it, but to do something. But, you know, a lot of people don't know quite what to do with their thoughts, do they? Or they forget them and they don't pay attention even to themselves, the importance of their thoughts.
That's very true. The opening segments of the book, the first couple of chapters, deal with just that. For example, the first chapter deals with spontaneous thought, and second chapter is more regarding targeted thought. And this is not to be overly technical writing. It's more to provoke and get a discussion going with my readers about what thought is all about as it relates to everyday experiences, and whether or not we act on those thoughts or feel they're necessary to act on, and how they come into our consciousness.
How would you say the media controls our thinking?
Well, I think to a great deal, if we're one that simply relies on quick sound bites and absorbs those without any critical thought analysis, we become very susceptible to what the media has to say. And then it's a question of the choices we make in terms of which media, whether it be print or electronic media, whether it's the internet or whether it's the news media itself via cable and broadcast channels.
So when we talk about silent thought, one phrase comes to my mind very quickly, the silent majority, and I guess that is really the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it's so. I mean, I think that we have gotten ourselves into a mindset as Americans that we leave the critical decisions, the important decisions, to a small few, primarily, and the book is more tailored to what is occurring in Washington, D.C., as it relates to our national politicians. So we leave those thinking that it's going to be just fine with a small few, instead of remembering that it's up to every American to be part of that process in different ways, of course.
Now, you've already mentioned spontaneous thought. That's your first chapter. Your second chapter is targeted thought. Let's talk a little bit about what you mean by spontaneous versus targeted. Let's start with spontaneous.
Well, I think what I mean by spontaneous is that we sit, and I give some examples. We might be sitting in a coffee shop, for example, and we're just sitting there. We might be reading, we might be writing, and we're really interacting with all of those triggers that hit our consciousness, as well as we might see other people, hear other conversations, overhear other conversations. So throughout our day, even through our work day, we are exposed to a lot of thought triggers that create spontaneous thought. And that's just what it is. And that sometimes is very fleeting. We sometimes try to, I mentioned in the book that sometimes we have a thought and then we think to ourselves, wow, this is powerful. This means a lot. And then before you know it, it's no longer resides in our consciousness. And we wonder, what was that thought? And I know it was good, but I just can't remember exactly what it was.
Boy, if I don't write it down, it's gone. I know that.
Right.
So then targeted thought.
Well, targeted thought is what I try to relate this to as I move through the book and then take this concept or take this concern and talk about what I believe are the five major crises facing our country. I look at targeted thought and try to connect that to how this affects these crises. And targeted thought, in my mind, is really through the either direct or indirect actions of others. You mentioned the media, for example. I believe the media is very much involved in targeting our thought. Now, one of the things I mentioned is, for example, advertisement, which is not a big problem, but so you don't have a problem necessarily. The people that are trying to sell a product or a service, they are targeting your thought. So if you pick up a newspaper and you see advertisements, that's usually what's happening there. But if you pick up a newspaper and you're, for example, reading an article that is biased in some way, well, the reality behind that is it's actually trying to target your thought and for a particular purpose, whether it's whatever bias it might have or whatever it's trying to accomplish. So the whole idea is to be able to understand what the target of thought is, that meaning what is someone trying to accomplish by that, or if you're within a group of people or you're listening to someone on a TV program, which is supposedly a news program, but yet you're hearing things that are trying to target you in a way to get you to absorb it and not only agree to it. So that's a lot of what the Targeted Thought chapter is about.
And today, at this moment in time, with this upcoming presidential election, a lot of efforts to target our thoughts, to convince us one way or another. And so you're saying there's never been a more critical time for us to re-examine our thinking, our thoughts.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And one of the reasons being that we are in a presidential election year, and I really believe America is at a crossroads in a lot of different ways, and that's the reason behind identifying what I believe are major crises in this country. So it's okay for a politician, for example, to target a thought. We want them to tell us what they believe, what they stand for, but we also want to, we should believe in the fact that we do have the discipline and a lot of time to understand whether or not that targeted thought is valid, and our, you know, what we're listening to has merit or doesn't have merit. But there's no question that, and again, you're also targeted in a highly charged political year such as this one by people who support a particular candidate. And let's just talk about the presidency. So you have people on both sides of that trying to target your thought and get you to believe a certain way in order to secure your vote.
Your book focuses on, as you've already pointed out, five crises in America. Let's just talk a couple of those, all the time we have, just to focus in on a couple. American crisis number one, it's chapter three, leadership in America. Share some things with us.
Well, again, I think everyone should set their expectations very high when it comes to our leaders. But one of the things I try to get into in this chapter is how do we choose our leaders? And, you know, through life, through childhood, through adulthood, we hopefully have people that we have identified as leaders. And that can change many times, but we want to be sure that and leadership has qualities that should be, as I said, a very high threshold. And for example, the things I talk about in this chapter are, I start with one of the most important positions in our country, and that is our president. And why leadership is so critical to that individual's ability to either enhance America or diminish America. And leadership, and the book is tries to be very fair in assessing our current president's behavior as a leader. And I think in some ways it's been not very good. And I try to identify that and try to get America to believe we should be a nation of leaders and not believe or entrust it into a small group of people, especially those few number of politicians in Washington, D.C.
I think it's so important, at least from my experience, that we as citizens must learn that we can really make a difference. Our thinking is important, our views, our opinions, but we have to gain that confidence to share them, and often to share them in the public arena in front of others, and that's quite challenging for many.
Well, without a doubt, and I think that it does have a lot to do with confidence and conviction. I think that most Americans are leaders in a lot of ways, whether it be family or workplace. But as a country, we can't keep just allowing the so-called leadership through our political process to entrust that's going to happen the right way. Every American has a role to play, some more than others. But first and foremost, and that's why the book started with thought, because you have to first have that thought and that critical analysis and take that time rather than accepting everything as is. And then I talk in the leadership into this chapter about what I believe the critical traits are for a successful leader.
Well, let's talk a little bit about chapter 4. That's American Crisis Number 2, Political Correctness. Boy, we hear that PC term all the time.
Right. Exactly. And it may not sound like a crisis, but it certainly is. And I think that the what's creeping into our country is, again, this has to do with thought. In my mind, political correctness is nothing more than a narrow viewpoint by very few people trying to control the thought and speech of others. And I think if the thought process is not critical, not only, as you said, without confidence, you won't really find a way to express it or think you need to express it, and you'd rather simply conform to what a political correctness, mindset might have you conform to. My we're keeping it very simple, is my litmus test on this is, I think of it in terms of American correctness and what has made this country great. I don't think we should be overly focused on this. And again, this is a term that's developed. This whole political correctness is a very narrow viewpoint in my mind in this country.
I know I have learned a lot by studying the founders of our country and the whole process they went through, and it really inspires anyone who will look into history, because history will repeat itself for good or bad.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that, just speaking of leadership, I think that we don't, and even as everyday Americans, we don't take enough thought and consideration of all the historical value that we have as a country, and continue to build on that and learn from that.
You also cover, I'm just going to read the other crises that you mention. You have American Crisis Number 3, which is race relations in America, American Crisis Number 4, politics in America, and American Crisis Number 5, open borders and immigration. Obviously, all these we hear in the news all the time, and they're very critical issues that have to be not only thought about, but take action upon to make America better, because we as citizens, as you point out, we're so distracted. It's hard to focus, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It's more of a distracted citizenry than it has ever been before. And some of that is because we just don't take the time, and we'd rather preoccupy ourselves with the more enjoyable aspects of life. Politics in general, and I think that in itself is probably why it's one of the most important chapters, is because it really takes a look at how politics affect every aspect of our life. And I think that a lot of Americans don't really believe that. You think of it in the abstract and sort of put it off to the side. I think it'll take care of itself.
Again, the title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis, and we've been talking to the author, Charlie Wirz. Charlie, what's the best way to get your book?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or ArchwayPublishing.com.
Thank you so much, Charlie, so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Winnie the Mini Horse. The book is co-authored by mother and daughter team, Andra Ebert and Morgan Ebert, who reside in the great state of Illinois in the United States of America. And because Morgan is unable to join us today, Andra's going to step in and take the reins. Welcome, Andra, to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Jay.
This is well illustrated, and because of the size of the book, 28 pages, my presumption is that your target audience is younger children. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We wanted to bring the story to young children because I think they can relate to it.
Wonderful. This is a book that has a, besides just the entertainment value, what was the motivation behind writing Winnie the Mini Horse? What was the reason you decided to share the story?
Well, it was really twofold. One, both my daughter and I are avid readers, and we really hope that the children share our love of reading. The second point was we wanted to share the importance of therapy animals working in long-term care, Alzheimer's units, veterans' homes, schools, hospitals, those kinds of things. Traditionally, it has been smaller animals such as dogs, cats, you know, sometimes birds and things like that. Well, for us, we use American miniature horses as therapy animals. So we actually take the horses into the facilities. So we wanted to share that. It's a relatively new approach to therapy work, and so we wanted to highlight that.
How long have you folks been involved in therapy work with horses and with animals?
Well, with animals, it started way back when Morgan began riding horses. I didn't grow up with horses, so my involvement started when she actually started riding horses. She was about 12 or so, I think. And so it's been quite long-term now. But I had read about this article using miniature horses, and I was fascinated. And so when I retired from work, I talked to my husband, and we decided that we could do this. So I then proceeded to do some more research and hooked up with a gal named Kate Basher in Kansas City and went out, visited her, fell in love with her miniature horses, and a month later I had two of my own. So it's been almost 2 years now.
2 years. And when you say miniature horses, they come in all sizes and shapes from what I have seen. How would you describe the ones that you use in therapy? Are they the more barrel-chested type of minis, or are they the smaller, petites-looking looking horses?
Well, ours are a little bit smaller, and they're actually more slender. They are actually a horse. Their body structure, the bone structure, everything is identical to a horse. It's just miniaturized. So when we're standing, the last hair of their mane, in order to be an A American miniature horse, has to be 34 inches or less.
Wow.
Mine stand at 32, 31, and 30. So they very well meet the criteria. If I'm standing next to them, their head is at my hip, and I'm about 5'6", so that can give you an idea of where they're at.
That's an amazing size. In therapy, using these animals, how are you? What kind of response are you getting? Obviously, it's something that is helpful, but have you seen anything that really surprised you, even in your use of mini horses with therapy?
Absolutely. There's been instances where you have residents who may not have been verbal for a long time, and they will be verbal with the horses. I had a particular woman that I was visiting, and usually when I'm visiting, I'm down, especially if they're in wheelchairs, try to be about eye level. And so I was trying to engage with her, and she wanted nothing to do with me. She was looking at Bailey, one of my horses. She's a black and white pinto. Mm. And she grabbed Bailey by the face and began talking to her with words that I couldn't necessarily understand. And the staff later told me that she was really nonverbal with the family and staff alone. So, but she was verbal with Bailey. So the next visit we went on, I tried to get her to talk to the other two horses, and she wanted nothing to do with them. Hmm. It's only Bailey. So it is something with that horse that triggers a response in this woman to be verbal. And that's an amazing thing to watch. Just yesterday, had another woman that really is basically nonverbal, and she mouthed thank you to me.
Wow.
And those are the times I go out and I cry a little bit. I go out to the car, you know, so nobody sees me.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah,
fascinating.
You know, the response that people have, I said, if I could bottle it, I'd be rich. Just the smiles, the engagement. People say, well, what makes a therapy work? That's part of it, is the engagement with something. I have people who normally don't reach out and do anything, try to reach out and pet and touch the animals. That's part of the therapy work that we do.
Incredible thing that you do in your work, your field work. You have decided to write and share the story of Winnie. Describe for my listeners who Winnie is in this story and why she's a key, or he, is it a he or a she?
It's a she.
Thank you. Why she is the key character, and what makes her different?
Well, the reason we decided to base the story and hopefully more stories around Winnie is we got Winnie when she was 4 months old, so she hadn't begun her training yet. So we are taking her from really ground zero to a fully trained therapy horse. So she's going to go through many changes and plateaus and learning experiences such as walking upstairs, being in elevators. I mean, things you typically don't think with horses. And so we got to talking, my daughter and I, and it was like, you know, that's like kids moving from grade to grade and learning new skills. You know, I have a 9-year-old grandson that all of a sudden goes, oh, we've got to do division. Do you know what division is?
Hmm.
You know, so I'm looking at the new things he's experiencing, and Winnie is experiencing the same things. And so we wanted to follow her growth. When we got her, she was 4 months old. She became part of our herd. We already had two horses. We had Bailey and Jasper, who had been with us for over a year. So it was getting acclimated even to a new family. Sometimes, you know, kids are experiencing half brothers and sisters and stepbrothers and sisters and stepmoms and all sorts of new things. Winnie was experiencing the same thing. She came from her original family. All of a sudden, she's taken away and put in a new family. So she's adjusting to a new family. So even though we're using a horse, there's a lot of themes that go through the story.
I'm gathering from how you've described this that almost, although you may not have intended it to do so, there is an underlying therapy for children who might have special events in their life that they need to cope with.
Absolutely. And we talk about that. When we go to visit schools, when we visit certain places, we talk about, you know, you may be afraid to try something new, but look at Winnie. She was able to do this. So we try to relate it to the kids. Absolutely.
Fabulous. The book itself is only 28 pages. Is there an age limit, or is there any child that has read this book that maybe has not responded? What has been the response?
The response has been incredible. We decided early on, Morgan and I did, that when we got the book, we were going to donate books to libraries and schools.
Beautiful.
So we have gone around the entire county. Now, we live in a very small county in Illinois. I think the total population is like 33,000, so we're not very big. But we've visited at least 8 or 9 schools, donated books to their library. And when we do, the teachers are like, they're driving me crazy because everybody wants the book. Because when we go in, Winnie actually hoof prints the book for them.
Really?
So she actually puts her hoof print in the front of the book. So we read the book to the kids. Winnie hoof prints it, and then it's in their library for them to get. And they said, you know, kids are fighting to be able to check out the book, which is wonderful.
That's a beautiful response.
That's what we want.
Oh, that's great. Now, you have a book that is a little bit unique in the children's era. How would you describe it that maybe makes it a little bit different from some of the other books that are trying to attract children's interests?
Well, I think the fact that the character is real, that you actually can follow up in a number of ways. You can follow us on Facebook and actually see her and see her doing the things that we're planning. So I think it makes it very relatable. You can follow along with her. You can go with her progress as she's growing.
This is your first effort as an author. And yes. And I'm understanding that you haven't been put off by the challenge. You've overcome some and were able to get this done. The illustrations, how did that come about and how long did it take?
Oh, it took several months for the illustrations, because what I would do is when I was working with the illustrator, I would send actual pictures, and then she would send me back proofs, and then we would go over them again and maybe send some suggestions. I laughed. Morgan is so particular. At one point, there's a picture of Winnie with a halter on her face, and the halter wasn't correct. Hmm. And Morgan goes, I know no one else would know that, but I know that, and most people will know that, so we have to correct that.
Wow.
So it's little details like that. The characters and the horses, you know, we described very clearly, and then sent pictures of them also.
Did the story take very long, or was that something that came together rather quickly?
That actually came together quickly. Morgan sat down, wrote out about 18 different points, and we chose and threw away some, kept some, altered some. I said the most difficult thing is trying to choose your words so carefully, because you have such limited space, to make sure that your idea gets across and that it's relatable. I said, before I always would have thought, oh, it's so easy to write a kid's book, just sit down and whip it out. Well, that's not true.
No, it's not.
It's very demanding and it's very exacting.
What's the moral of your story?
Anyone can do anything, truly.
Beautiful.
We're taking a horse with absolutely no skills and teaching it to provide a huge service. Anyone else can work on themselves and improve themselves to offer something to other people.
Excellent children's story. The title again is Winnie the Mini Horse, with co-authors mother Andra Ebert and daughter Morgan Ebert. Thank you for joining me today. My listeners will hopefully want to get a copy of this and maybe even share it with their school library. How do they do so?
They can go to Archway, obviously. They can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They're all carrying it.
Do you have a website yet that they can access, or is that in the future?
Yes, winniethemininhorse.com.
Excellent. Understand you have another story almost completed and almost ready for presses, so we look forward to talking with you about that in the future. Listeners, if you're looking for them online, the last name is spelled E-B-E-R-T, so you can do a search there and find out about Winnie the Mini Horse. And again, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.